Please turn in your scriptures to 1 Samuel chapter 9. We'll be reading the entire chapter together, focusing on the first 25 verses. This is the word of the living and true God. There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechorath, the son of Aphia, a Benjaminite, a mighty man of power. And he had a choice and handsome son whose name was Saul. There was not a more handsome person than he among the children of Israel. From his shoulders upward he was taller than any of the people. Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. And Kish said to his son Saul, "Please, take one of the servants with you and arise, go and look for the donkeys." So he passed through the mountains of Ephraim and through the land of Shalisha, but they did not find them. Then they passed through the land of Sha'alim, and they were not there. Then he passed through the land of the Benjaminites, but they did not find them. When they had come to the land of Zuf, Saul said to his servant who was with him, "Come, let us return, lest my father cease caring about the donkeys and become worried about us." And he said to him, "Look now, there is in this city a man of God, and he is an honorable man. All that he says surely comes to pass. So let us go there. Perhaps he can show us the way that we should go." Then Saul said to his servant, "But look, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread in our vessels is all gone, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have?" And the servant answered Saul again and said, "Look, I have here at hand 1/4 of a shekel of silver. I will give that to the man of God to tell us our way." Formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he spoke thus, "Come, let us go to the seer." For he who is now called a prophet was formerly called a seer. Then Saul said to his servant, "Well said, come, let us go." So they went to the city where the man of God was. As they went up the hill to the city, they met some young women going up to draw water and said to them, "Is the seer here?" And they answered them and said, "Yes, there he is, just ahead of you. Hurry now, for today he came to this city because there is a sacrifice of the people today on the high place. As soon as you come into the city, you will surely find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat until he comes, because he must bless the sacrifice. Afterward, those who are invited will eat. Now therefore go up, for about this time you will find him." So they went up to the city. As they were coming into the city, there was Samuel coming out toward them on his way up to the high place. Now the Lord had told Samuel in his ear the day before Saul came, saying, "Tomorrow about this time I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him commander over my people Israel, that he may save my people from the hand of the Philistines. For I have looked upon my people, because their cry has come to me." So when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said to him, "There he is, the man of whom I spoke to you. This one shall reign over my people." Then Saul drew near to Samuel in the gate and said, "Please tell me, where is the seer's house?" Samuel answered Saul and said, "I am the seer. Go up before me to the high place, for you shall eat with me today. And tomorrow I will let you go and tell you all that is in your heart. But as for your donkeys that were lost 3 days ago, do not be anxious about them, for they have been found. And on whom is all the desire of Israel? Is it not on you and on your father's house?" And Saul answered and said, "Am I not a Benjaminite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then do you speak like this to me?" Now Samuel took Saul and his servant and brought them into the hall and had them sit in the place of honor among those who were invited. There were about 30 persons. And Samuel said to the cook, "Bring the portion which I gave you, of which I said to you, set it apart." So the cook took up the thigh with its upper part and set it before Saul. And Samuel said, "Here it is, what was kept back. It was set apart for you. Eat, for until this time it has been kept for you since I invited the people." So Saul ate with Samuel that day. When they had come down from the high place into the city, Samuel spoke with Saul on the top of the house. They arose early, and it was about the dawning of the day that Samuel called to Saul on the top of the house, saying, "Get up, that I may send you on your way." So Saul arose, and both of them went outside, he and Samuel. And as they were going down to the outskirts of the city, Samuel said to Saul, "Tell the servant to go on ahead of us." And he went on ahead. "But you stand here a while, that I may announce to you the word of God." Thus far the reading of God's holy and infallible word. You may be seated. To lose things seems to be a natural part of our everyday existence, doesn't it? "Honey, did you see my tie?" "Dad, where's my volleyball?" "Sir, I can't seem to find the wrench you asked for. Where did you say it was?" Often we embark on a fruitless search in hope that the item will turn up somewhere. At other times, we give up on the search only to find that shortly thereafter, and to our embarrassment, discover that it hadn't been all that far away anyway. You know, the classic, where are my glasses? And there they are on the top of your head. But the worst is when we spent hours looking in futility, only to have someone else find it almost immediately after they begin searching for it. Have you ever lost something, only to discover that you've found something even more valuable? What would it be like if this did happen to you, that you lost something and you found something of much greater value? In our passage today, you will see that Saul went searching for some lost donkeys, only to unexpectedly discover that he was one upon whom the nation of Israel had placed their desire and whom God had appointed to be king. The people of Israel had just asked Samuel that they might have a king. What sort of king did the people of Israel ask for? They asked for a king like all the other nations. This seems to be consistent with the people of Israel, in that though God was their king and God had done many powerful things, even as we read in Jeremiah this morning in Jeremiah 7, that the people of Israel still were not 100% behind God, as it were. They were not 100% following him. You remember as God led the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt, they witnessed many miracles that he had performed. As he led them into the promised land, once again they saw many of the miracles that God had given for them and the victory that he had provided for them. And by the time you come to the book of Judges, you see the people had turned away from following God to serve other gods. In a discussion that we had this morning, it was even mentioned that when David was hiding from Saul and he was in the house with his wife, and his wife took something and put it in the bed. What did he put in the bed? An idol. You see, there was even an idol in David's own household, which is shocking. It was perhaps his wife. But the point is that the people of Israel were always looking for something else. They were always looking for a king or a leader or someone who was not the living and the true God. We find ourselves here in the book of 1 Samuel. The people haven't changed at all. They had come to Samuel and asked that they would be given a king like all the other nations. And it wasn't because Samuel was such an ungodly judge or an ungodly person. In fact, they asked him later on, or he asked them later on, "Have I ever done anything? Have I ever taken anything from you?" And their answer was, "No, you've been a good judge, but we want another king. Your sons are wicked. They go after bribes. They pervert justice." And Israel is adamant and set in their desire that they would be like all the other nations. And what better way to be like all the other nations than to have a king like all the other nations? For they desire neither the judges nor God to rule over them. You saw last time that people would rather serve oppressive leaders than God. And I want to show you by God's grace today that God reveals his purposes in our lives through seemingly insignificant events. You will see Saul's futile search and Saul's unanticipated surprise. First of all, his futile search. God uses Samuel's fruitless search to bring him to Samuel. We are introduced to the man Saul, but we're introduced to him through his father. There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abdiel, the son of Zeor, the son of Bechorath, the son of Aphia, a Benjaminite, a man of power. The narrative turns now from the people asking for a king to the family of the one whom God would appoint as king. And we're introduced to Kish. What did you notice about the description of Kish? You notice that he is a mighty man of power. He is a man of the Benjaminite tribe, which is the smallest of the tribes, arguably perhaps the most wicked of the tribes, for they were almost decimated. Remember when they killed the Levite's concubine? And he sent her to all the various parts of Israel that they might go and attack the Benjaminites. And they almost succeeded in destroying them. There were only 600 men left of the tribe of Benjamin. All the rest were wiped out. It's surprising in some ways because wasn't Benjamin the son of Rachel, whom Jacob loved most dearly along with Joseph? And you would think that among the people of Benjamin, that somehow Benjamin would be a little higher in standing, but they were not. They were the smallest, the weakest. And of those 600 men that survived, we're told that the Israelites sought wives for them. And I think this detail is important later on in the account of Saul, is that they took from Jabesh-Gilead 400 women. For all those who went up to attack the tribe of Benjamin were called and upon the curse of death. And when they looked and they took a census at all who came to battle against the Benjaminites, they found that no man from Jabesh-Gilead was there. And they went and they destroyed the city, but captured 400 young virgins, young women, and gave them to the Benjaminites as wives. Then, of course, you know the story of the Benjaminites going to the festival at Shiloh and capturing another 200 women. Their fathers hadn't given them away, but they just took them. And it's likely that one of these women from Jabesh-Gilead was a relative of Saul. And you'll see that there is a close relationship between Saul and the men of Jabesh-Gilead in chapter 11. When Jabesh-Gilead is attacked by the Philistines, Saul comes to their rescue. And then when Saul, after his death, and his body is hung on the wall of the Philistine city, who is it that come and rescue his body from the wall? Is it not the men of Jabesh-Gilead? So Saul is of the tribe of Benjamin, of a son of a man who is a mighty man of power. That phrase is often found in the Old Testament to describe a man of war, one who is a warrior, who is able to battle and defeat his enemy. It is also possible that this phrase could refer to a man of political and social standing. And it does appear that Kish was a wealthy man. At least we're told that he lost some female donkeys, and they're very specific. He lost some female donkeys. They were of more value than the male donkeys because they were able to produce milk and offspring. But Kish is a mighty man of power. That's how you're introduced to this man. And this man, Kish, he had a son. He had a choice and handsome son whose name was Saul. There was not a more handsome person than he among all the children of Israel. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. Do you notice the description of Saul, Kish's son? He was a choice and handsome man. Literally, he was young, a young man and good. He was pleasant and good looking. From his shoulders above, he was a head taller than anyone else. He was pleasant. He, from all appearances, had it all. The women would just, what's that word, woo when he walks by. Their heads would turn when they saw this man, Saul. Notice that the emphasis is on his appearance. He was more handsome than anyone else in the land of Israel. He had everything that kings of other nations had, and he had everything that a king of Israel ought to have in their view and in their estimation. One lesson to learn here is far too often we judge by outward appearances, but good-looking and beautiful people can be just as ugly and hate-filled and deadly as anyone on the inside. You see, the Israelites, they wanted to be like all the other nations. And who else but to have a handsome, tall, commandeering type of a man to lead them, to go before them, to fight their battles? If there's any man in the land of Israel, this is the man. But notice the contrast between Kish, a man of mighty power, and Saul, choice and handsome. Now, Kish had lost some sheep, and he sends his son Saul on a fruitless quest. Having been a man of wealth, having lost some donkeys, he says to Saul, "Please take one of the servants with you. Arise and go look for the donkeys." We're not told why they were lost. We're not told how they escaped. We're not even told where they went. And that's the point, if the donkeys are lost. But why would you worry about donkeys? Well, it was a big deal for Kish. But it also doesn't sound like there was very good herdsmanship being practiced here. Why would the donkeys be lost? We learn why they're lost later on, but it's not the reason for which you might think they were lost. And apparently to lose donkeys was also not all that uncommon. And so Saul and his servant go on a search. And I love the description of this search. So they passed through the mountains of Ephraim and through the land of Shalisha, but they did not find them. Then they passed through the land of Sha'alim. They were not there. Then they passed through the land of Benjamin, but they did not find them. You get this idea of an exhaustive search, that they went from place to place, and they looked in this corner, and they looked in that corner, and they looked in that corner, and they did not find them. No matter where they went, there were no lost donkeys that to be found. It was a wide-ranging search. It was a search that proved fruitless. And finally, they find themselves in the land of Zuf, which is near the city of Ramah, the city of Samuel. And it is there that Saul finally says, "I want to call it quits. Come, let us return, lest my father cease caring about the donkeys and become worried about us." He has his father in mind. He wants to stop searching because they've been gone for 3 days. He doesn't want his father to begin worrying about his son, rather than to begin worrying about the donkey. And so he says to his servant, "Let's go. Let's go home." But Saul makes one final effort in search for the donkey. But this is not Saul's idea. It is his servant's idea. His servant says, "Look now, there is in this city a man of God, and he is an honorable man. And all that he says surely comes to pass. So let us go there. Perhaps he can show us the way that we are to go." You see, while Saul was ready to quit and to go back to his father, his servant wasn't. He wanted to make one last-ditch effort to find the animals. And he knew that it was very possible that there was in this city the seer who could tell them where the donkeys were. What's interesting is that the servant was very well aware that there was a prophet in Israel, and that this city of Ramah, near where they were, was the city of the prophet. We're told that he was aware that he was an honorable man. That is, he was a man of good reputation. He was held in high esteem by all. But even more than that, everything that he says comes to pass. He is reliable and trustworthy. His word is good. And who else would you want to go to? But a man of God who is reliable, who, when he says something is going to take place, that it does take place. And so the servant says, let us go there. Let us check with him. Maybe he can tell us where to find these donkeys. Maybe he can guide us to them so that you can return to your father with them in hand and not empty-handed. What's interesting is that apparently Saul didn't know this or didn't come to mind. The first thought on his mind was not, let us go to the seer, but let us go home. Perhaps the prophet wasn't high on his list of priorities. Perhaps he wasn't high on his list of interests. Perhaps the prophet wasn't high on his list of things to do if I can't find what I'm looking for. Already, you see here, Saul's interest and knowledge in spiritual things isn't promising. This is a man who would be appointed to be the king and the leader over the people of God. But his first thought is not to go to God and to seek his guidance for the lost sheep, but rather, I can't do it. Let's go home. And so, not only that, but notice Saul's objection. What shall we give to the man? We don't have anything in our hand, for the bread in our vessels is all gone. There is no present to bring him. What do we have? Saul makes an objection. We can't go to this man of God. Our bread is all gone. We've eaten it up these last 3 days, and we have nothing else to give. We have no present. Essentially, he's saying we can't go because we can't pay for the prophet's words. He doesn't seem to think really that going to the prophet is going to be of much use at all. But the servant isn't deterred. He looks, searches, and he says, behold, look, I have in my hand 1/4 of a shekel of silver. I will give that to the man of God to tell us our way. He had a shekel. A shekel was about enough money to provide for a small family for a week or two of sustenance. I tried to look it up, and it's about $5 to $80, depending on the source. It really was hard to find how much a shekel would be worth in today's money. But it was enough to provide for a small family for a week or two. And the servant says, look, I have a quarter of a shekel. I just happen to have it. I found it on me. It begs the question, why does the servant have the coin and Saul does not? The servant is more willing to use this and very willing to use this to give to the seer. And then you have this narrative interruption. Formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he spoke thus, come, let us go to the seer. For he who is now called the prophet was formerly called the seer. Why is that there? It's there to slow down the narrative for a moment, to increase the anticipation of what was about to happen. It indicates how a person would go to the seer. Come, let us go to the seer. In other words, those who went to the seer purposed from the very beginning to see the seer, who was formerly called a prophet, bringing these two offices together. And you see, Saul and the servant had not set out to seek the seer. This was happenstance. They just happened to be near the city where the seer, where the prophet was. You see, many are reluctant to seek the Lord for things that they believe are insignificant. However, nothing is too insignificant for the Lord. If the Lord God watches over the sparrows and the hairs of your head, he'll watch over these things too. Those things, those little things, those insignificant things that you are concerned about. So Saul finally says, well said, let's go. Let's go to the prophet, to where the man of God is. And so they go. You see, here's another lesson, that many turn to God when all else fails. How often don't we search and search and search for something and don't find it? And when we can't find it, then suddenly we remember, oh, maybe we ought to pray. And maybe in some superstitious way, God will bring it to us. God does not work superstitiously. God does answer prayers. But we ought to bring our requests our concerns before him when we begin praying, when we begin searching, and not when all else has failed. And so they go to make this initial inquiry of the Lord. They went up the hill to the city. They met some young women going there to draw water and said to them, "Is the seer here?" Notice something else that happened. As they were going up to the city, they happened to meet with some young women who were coming out of the city to get water, drawing it from the well. It was the perfect opportunity to ask, and they were obviously travelers. "Is the seer here?" They were asking for directions. And you can imagine these young women seeing this handsome young man, this choice young man, coming towards them and stopping and asking them this question concerning the prophet. And what is their answer? "Yes, there he is, just ahead of you. Hurry now, for today he came to the city because there is a sacrifice of the people today on the high place." There's a sense of urgency in their answer. "Yes, he's here, and he's right there in the city. You better go quick because he's going to go to this festival. He's going to go to this sacrifice, and you better catch him if you want to ask him your question. Otherwise, you might have to wait for some time." About this time, he is going to the sacrifice, and you will find him. These young women seemed to know an awful lot about what was going on. They were interested in the local happenings of their own city. And so they could easily answer Saul's question concerning the seer. You see, God reveals his purposes in our lives through seemingly insignificant events. The donkeys of Kish were lost. Saul went to find them. Saul happened to be at the city of the prophet, and he happens to meet these women who tell him that Samuel just happens to be in the city today for a sacrifice. But now notice the unanticipated surprise that Saul receives. As Samuel surprises Saul with an unexpected invitation to dinner, an intimation of even greater honor. As they were coming to the city, we are told that they meet Samuel. Verse 15, "Now the Lord had told Samuel in his ear the day before Saul came, saying, 'Tomorrow about this time I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin. You shall anoint him commander over my people.'" It isn't until verse 14, that Samuel is mentioned by name. As they were coming into the city, as they come to the city gates, there is Samuel coming out toward them on their way to the high place. And then the writer pauses for a moment and says, "This is a fulfillment of something that the Lord has said." The Lord has said that he is going to send a man from the tribe of Benjamin. And here comes Saul from the tribe of Benjamin seeking the seer. And he is the one who shall be the commander over my people. It's interesting that that word that is translated commander is not the word for king. You might have expected that he would use the word, "He shall reign over my people." But no, he shall be the commander over my people, the leader, the prince over my people. Notice also in these two verses, 15 and 16, how many times the phrase or the words "my people" occur. In verse 16 alone, it occurs three times. In verse 17, it occurs once again. The Lord says to Samuel, "You shall anoint him over my people, that he may save my people. I have looked upon my people." These people that belong to God are the very ones that had said, "Give us a king like all the other nations." While they had disowned God, God did not disown them. God still saw these people, this people of Israel, as a special nation, as a special people, and he still identified them as his own. And so he says to them, "Anoint him that he may deliver," that is, save or rescue my people from under the hand of the Philistine oppression. And again, you have this similar description as you find throughout the book of Judges. You remember that cycle of disobedience, discipline, despair, deliverance. The people of Israel are under the discipline of the Lord by the hands of the Philistines. And it appears that they are very oppressed. For they cry, for their cry has come out to me, says the Lord. The Philistines were a very oppressive people upon the nation of Israel. And they cried out to God for deliverance, as they had in the book of Judges. And notice that God is compassionate. He hears the cry of his people. And brothers and sisters, do not think otherwise. However, and whatever strife you may face, God will hear your cry, and he will deliver you from it. Whatever strife you face may have been appointed for your good. And that's what God has done through the strife of those that afflicted them throughout the time of the judges and the time here now of Samuel and Saul. But even after all of this, the people had rejected God as their king and still wanted to be like a nation around them. Then God says, "This is the one who shall reign over my people." And again, this is not that usual word for reign. It comes from the word, it often means to hold back, to restrain oneself, therefore to rule. God has put this, has appointed this man to restrain, to hold back, to rule the people of God. Why that word? You remember the description of what the king would be like in chapter 8, that he would be oppressive, that his hand would be heavy upon the nation of Israel. And so this man has appointed to reign, to lead my people, the people of God. And so when Samuel meets with Saul, Saul asks him a question. Can you tell us how to get to the seer's house? There's the prophet himself standing right there in front of him. And Saul still does not recognize him. Does not know that this is the prophet in Israel who was the leader of God's people, arguably the most powerful person in the land of Israel at this time. And he asks him, "Can you tell me where the seer's house is?" There's another example of Saul's spiritual indifference, Saul's spiritual indifference, as it were, that he did not even recognize the one whom God, through whom God spoke to his people. And so Saul answered him and said, "I am the seer. I'm the one you're looking for." "Oh, well, I got a question for you," right? No. Samuel continues, "Go up before me to the high place, for you shall eat with me today, and tomorrow I will let you go and will tell you that all that is in your heart." And so as he answers, he invites Saul to a feast. Is that what Saul was expecting when he woke up in the morning? On the third day when he was looking for his father's lost sheep? "You know, I think I'll go to Ramah, I'll go meet Samuel, and I'll join him at a feast." No. That was probably the last thing on his mind. The last thing on his mind didn't even come close to dreaming that he'd be honored like this. And yet he meets Samuel and he is invited to join him in the feast. There is this totally unexpected invitation, but also this totally unexpected hospitality. He says, "Tomorrow I will let you go. You don't have to worry about lodging, where you're going to sleep the night. I will let you go tomorrow." And Samuel gives some totally unexpected news. "The donkeys have been found that you've been searching for." Saul hadn't even had an opportunity to ask his question. That's the whole reason that he went to Samuel. Perhaps he might know where his father's donkeys were. And remember what the servant said. "Everything that this man says comes to pass. He is an honorable man." And so he tells him the donkeys have been found. And then he makes this totally unexpected statement. "On whom is all the desire of Israel? Is it not on you and on all your father's house?" Can you imagine? This is the most puzzling statement to Saul of all. Desire of Israel on me? And notice his response. Am I not a Benjaminite? You know, the littlest of all of those tribes? And am I not part of the least significant clan of the Benjaminites? I'm the most unlikely person that could be chosen to be king. Now, Saul may be somewhat modest here. We're told that his father was a mighty man, a man of power, well known, and perhaps even wealthy. But he says, why do you speak to me like this? This is not what I've been trained for. This is not what I expected. All I wanted was an answer to my question, not a feast and a place to sleep and to be told that Israel wants me to be their king. And so Saul is taken by Samuel, and he brings them to the hall and has them sit in the place of honor among those who were invited. This was a prestigious meal. I always thought that when Samuel took Saul, that it was a citywide feast, that everyone and anyone could come to this feast and participate in it. But we're told that only those who were invited, and we're given the number of those who were invited, 30. It was a small number. And yet these 30 men, these 30 persons, had been invited by Samuel for this special feast. Something important was going to happen. And they would not start until Samuel came. And they could not start until Samuel came. And when Samuel came, he came with Saul, to whom he gave not the lowest position, but the most honorable position in that feast. Here are these 30 men who had received that invitation, and some stranger walks in and sits down at that place of honor. What's going on? Who were these men? It's possible that they were the leaders. This would be their first introduction to the one upon whom all the desire of Israel was laid. They were likely the community leaders, those who would be the supporters of a leader and were good allies to have. You know, you remember that phrase, it's not what you know, but who you know. Well, here Samuel was introducing Saul to the leaders, to those who would support his leadership, as it were. And so he sat at the most prestigious place. And not only did he sit at the most prestigious place, the most honored place at the meal, but he was given the best portion of the sacrifice, literally the thigh and the upon it. That is the thigh and the accompanying fat, that which made it taste really good. And did you notice something else? That Samuel had set it apart. He had set it apart. Why did he set it apart? For Saul, this was unexpected. But for Samuel, it wasn't. He had been told by the Lord that he would come. And perhaps he had invited the men that day previous to come to this feast in preparation for the coming of this man whom God said was coming but had not yet identified. And so Saul is honored by Samuel. And after the meal, he returns with Samuel to his house. And there they spoke at length. Samuel spoke with Saul on the top of the house. Now, if you have the ESV, you will notice that it says something to the effect that a bed was spread for Saul on the roof, and he slept. This is because the ESV has followed the Septuagint in translating that particular portion of the text. But either way, whether Samuel spoke with Saul on the roof or he had a place to rest, either way, both of those would have taken place, conversation and rest. But Samuel doesn't appear to elaborate on his earlier statement concerning Saul and the desire of Israel at this point. That would be for tomorrow, for the next day. You see, God reveals his purposes in our lives through seemingly insignificant events. God leads Saul to Ramah, and he happens to meet with Samuel as he is exiting the city. And Samuel happens to have a place of honor for Samuel and happens to set aside this best portion of the sacrifice, this meal of honor for Saul to eat. But brothers and sisters, there was nothing happenstance about it. This passage screams of God's doctrine of providence. We ask the question, what are the works of God's providence? God's works of providence are his most holy, wise, and powerful preserving and governing of all his creatures and all their actions. Nothing that the Lord does is accidental or happenstance, even if it appears that way to you and to me. The Lord is directing all things in your life and in my life. Brothers and sisters, when you consider what is taken place in your life and the events, the good events and the difficult events and the horrific events, none of that takes God by surprise. God is using that for his glory and for your good, as difficult as that may seem. Did Saul expect any of this when he left in search of his father's donkeys? No. Were any of these events in themselves significant? No. Yet in God's hands, each and every moment is a significant working out of his purposes, even right now. God is working and directing the flow of history today toward the fulfillment of his purposes. Brothers and sisters, this includes the social instability in our land, the political instability in Venezuela, the fratricide in Nigeria, the fraying moral fabric of our land, you name it. God uses all this to accomplish his purposes for his glory. There is nothing in your life that is insignificant to the Lord. As I said earlier, if he cares for the sparrow and he knows the number of hairs that are upon your head, how much more will he care for you? But you see, the desire of Israel is not where it should have been. Israel wanted to be like all the other nations and to have a king like all the other nations. And God gave him one. He gave him a king who was not a man after his own heart, and therefore a man who was destined to fail. The desire of Saul was to find the donkeys, which he didn't find. Saul had all the looks of a good king, but was he a godly man? That's the question. Do not put your trust in outward appearances. Man, any man will disappoint. But there is a king who will never fail. Israel was placing their hopes in this king like all the nations. Israel was placing their hope in a as yet unknown man to lead them. Yet the king they wanted wasn't the king they needed. They needed a king who was a man after God's own heart, like King David. Yet even David failed. They needed one better. Israel needed a powerful, compassionate, and righteous king, the king toward whom David himself pointed. They needed the king, the Lord Jesus Christ, who is the king on high, on whom believers have placed all their hope. You see, the church believers place their hope in a known, powerful, and compassionate king, Jesus Christ. Christians understand that to hope in any other is foolishness. To put your hope in a president is foolishness. In a senator, in a congressman, in any other political leader, in any other leader, in any other man for eternal salvation is foolishness. For there is only one who can save. That is God's own Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, whom he sent, who is the King sitting at the right hand of God even now. You see, we serve a risen King. Jesus Christ, who died for his people, that you and I might be set free from the tyranny of the prince of this world, the devil. You serve the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. He will never disappoint. He is moving and guiding all things by his providence to its appointed end. Brothers and sisters, he is moving and guiding all things to its appointed end. That's God's providence. The end is not unknown. The Lord knows what is before you, even when you don't. And that's what this passage shows us as Saul, your throne, and cast yourself before the throne of the Lamb who was slain from before the foundation of the world. Indeed, there will be no greater joy than serving him who exalts the lowly and humbles the proud. Brothers and sisters, on whom is your desire set? Is your desire set on those around you? Is it set on the leaders, those purported to be leaders, those who have power? Or is your desire set on the one who is king, the one who lives and reigns forever? He is our God. He is the one who rules his people. Indeed, there is no seemingly insignificant event that he does not use to fulfill his grander purpose. Is your desire set on the Lord Jesus Christ?